This is Michael Johnson coming to you from the Intel Developer Forum at Moscone Center in San Francisco, California. I had a chance to sit down with Intel's Chief Technology Officer, Justin Ratner, to take a look at what's coming up this week at IDF.
Intel has any number of announcements we're gonna be talking about. We're gonna be demonstrating the new Penryn processor. We'll be talking about the next generation Nehalem processor that's coming out in 2008. We'll talk about some of our recent progress on the technology side, on the chip technology side, with our work towards bringing 32 nanometer technology to production. So we'll have lots of news there, and of course, there are always surprises at IDF. We always save a few things, so I think there'll be a few surprises along with the expected number of product announcements and showcases.
Now, we have these IDFs fairly frequently, and it's a lot of pressure to actually come out with new things all the time.
It certainly is.
And I know that, this morning in some of the briefings that we're talking about, some of the exciting Terascale things that are coming and the next step in parallel processing and whatnot. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to sort of that pressure? I mean, a lot of people have been talking about, Moore's Law couldn't be, it would have run out last century, but mm-hmm. these things keep coming up and up again. How do you sort of keep that kind of momentum up?
Well, you mentioned Moore's Law. Moore's Law is a demanding master, and I think we have learned to live with it, to manage it over these years. I always kind of chuckle when people talk about the end of Moore's Law, because we've never been able to see more than about 10 years into the future with Moore's Law. So, even though it appears, the next 10 years appears difficult, the last 10 years appeared difficult 10 years ago. So, I think we bring a lot of optimism to the effort. And I think it's a wonderful stimulus to innovation. I mean, it's a challenge, and sure, maybe you won't make it, but the chance that you might, I think, really spurs a lot of creative thinking, and it's what makes us get up in the morning. So it's a good thing.
So there's a lot of talk about, as we were mentioning before, parallel processing and multi-core processing. Mm-hmm. And I know that Intel's starting to explore some interesting possibilities on what kinds of, say, we'll call them human applications, that kind of performance can actually yield itself out to. Maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the possibilities that Intel's working on right now.
Yeah, we've been working in a number of different areas, and I guess what we're starting to see is what I would call the interesting intersection. So for a number of years, as we've talked about at previous IDFs, we've been working on new rendering technologies, new ways to create very high quality images in the computer using a technique known as ray tracing. More recently, we've been starting to look at some of these 3D virtual worlds and how they're rendered. We're beginning to see sort of an interesting opportunity, you might even say a synergy, between ray tracing and virtual worlds, because unlike a game where, an artist designing a scene in the game, can spend hours, days even, just crafting the perfect image and getting the lighting and the effects just right. When users are generating content, as they do more and more frequently now in these virtual worlds, they don't have the time, the skills, the inclination to spend a lot of time making it look good. So they put things together as easily as they can and sort of move on. And ray tracing is a technique that has the potential, anyway, if done right, to give you very high quality images, render it very high quality, without spending a lot of time crafting every bit of the scene.
Well, I was going to say, in movies, I think, with some people are used to say, it's not exactly rotoscoping, but it's kind of three-dimensional rotoscope where people have patched, what, ping-pong balls to people, and they sort of trace their movements. And, I think a lot of things, like movies like Happy Feet, for example, were made that way, where they sort of traced something like this. But this is very different. Can you sort of explain how ray tracing works?
Well, ray tracing quite literally duplicates the physics of light. I mean, it traces the light ray, and it can actually work either direction. It can either trace the path from the object to your eye, or from your eye to the object, and that path may be complicated in the sense that the ray may bounce off of other objects before it reaches you. It may hit various surfaces that are, more or less reflective or diffusive in nature. And so because it's doing the real physics, you sort of automatically get this very high quality, whereas in conventional raster graphics, lighting and shading is in fact somewhat artificial. And that's why artists today spend so much time. And I think ray tracing will make their life easier too. But for people doing their own content, if you don't like the lighting, then hang up another light and it'll all just work. And so it's very interesting as we've looked at applications for parallelism and focused on things like ray tracing, which is highly parallel in nature. Now we're starting to see these other opportunities that are driven, as you were suggesting, more by making things easier for people to use, as opposed to creating some sophisticated tool for an expert. So that's one technique. The other thing I think you were suggesting this is how do we capture body motion, right? People we're so amazed how enthusiastically the public greeted the Wii game console with its little accelerometer hand controller, which was just a tiny step towards capturing human motion, and we've been working on actually using video, just pointing cameras at people and capturing their body movements. And I think those the accelerometers of today will just give way to cameras. You'll just put up a camera and move around in front of the camera, and a lot of parallel processing will be used to convert those video images into motions that then animate characters inside a game or inside a virtual world.
No, it seems like the possibilities for that, as I think some of the other folks like Jerry Batista and others were alluding to, this really is the whole next step with really using this, finding the places where parallel processing can really be practically used. I think he's called it extracting the parallelism out of those kinds of technologies where we may not have seen it or known it was before. Mm-hmm. What other things are you going to be talking about this week?
Well, so we're going to focus this week on this whole issue of virtual worlds. Because we see it as such a sort of a rich environment in which to explore the uses of parallel computing technology. And, the more we've looked at it, and I'm talking about, things like the massively multiplayer games and Second Life and the other virtual worlds, the more we've come to understand that the potential here for absorbing much of this technology is really amazing. I mean, in a simple web page view, the server doesn't really do all that much work. It goes out, grabs the page image. Maybe it's a dynamic page, so it has to assemble a few bits and pieces and then send that back to the client. But in a virtual world, or a multiplayer game, you've got to be updating views, 10, 20, 30 times a second. So, gameplay has or the virtual experience has the same interactivity. Well, we've been running the numbers and, 10x is sort of a lower bound on performance, and more typically 100x, both at the client and at the server, and even in the network, because to be able to deliver that experience, You have to be moving a lot more bits across the wire or across the air, as the case may be. So it's a very demanding technology. And if it's really the future of the internet, and many people are suggesting that it is, then we've got a lot of work to do if that's going to be a rich experience for people all over the world.
And so how do you tie in all of that together? Because this is what it's all about, sort of taking these possibilities, taking the looming technologies that are coming with parallelism and multi-core processing, and also the people that are out there that are actually supposed to develop some of the software for that. How do you tie it all in together?
Well, it's a complex process, and I think what we're doing more and more of is actually engaging developers and users in the process of defining what these next generation systems look like. We're just starting to talk about our Larrabee architecture, which we'll demonstrate in 2008, hopefully bring to market in 2009, and what's really interesting about it, almost more than the sort of the architectural issues, is how it was developed and defined. And essentially we went out and we engaged some of the brightest minds on the software development side, and really built an architecture that was responsive to their needs. So there's tremendous excitement in that product, and I think it just argues for doing much more of that, getting developers, getting end users engaged in the early phase of the product definition, so you really come to market with something very compelling.
Okay, so I'm saying for it's a parallel thinking for parallel processing.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Justin Radner is the Chief Technology Officer for Intel. It's been great talking with you, and good luck this week at IDF.
Same here. Thank you very much.